open to a bill and working with legislators on that, whether something that I file or whether something they file.
Solving the state's unfunded retirement liability. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, April 11th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, scientists work to save the unique HAARP facility.
HAARP is in Alaska because we wanted to be underneath a region of concentrated ionosphere, which is called the auroral oval.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Republican Senate candidate Dan Sullivan has kept up his fundraising momentum. Sullivan's campaign reports he raised $1.3 million in the first quarter of the year. That's a bit more than the former state attorney general raised during the prior quarter. Incumbent Democratic Senator Mark Begich also reports raising more than $1 million during the first quarter. Other challengers in the race haven't yet announced their totals, which aren't due until next week. The legislature has made little progress on Governor Sean Parnell's goal of addressing the state's looming retirement problem. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports Parnell hopes to change that by filing a bill that reintroduces his plan to deal with Alaska's $12 billion unfunded liability.
Governor Sean Parnell's retirement bill dropped on Thursday night, with little more than a week before lawmakers gavel out. The idea is identical to the proposal he introduced going into session. It transfers $3 billion from the state's savings reserves into the retirement trust fund. It also commits the state to making a $500 million payment into the system every year. It's been likened to taking on a 15-year mortgage instead of a 30-year one. Except, instead of paying off a house, the goal is to put less pressure on future state budgets and guard Alaska's credit rating. But the plan didn't go anywhere. Lawmakers were reluctant to deal with the pension issue without a separate bill in front of them. Parnell does not agree with that line of thinking.
Actually, they did see a bill for me. I submitted my proposal in our budget proposal. So to act concerned about not having a bill from the governor when we submitted one by December 15 as required by the Constitution is a little disingenuous.
As Parnell's plan languished, members of the House Finance Committee tried to push forward their own way of dealing with the pensions of public employees. Their proposal would have stretched out teacher retirement payments over a longer span of time, and they unsuccessfully tried attaching it to the education bill. Parnell described the result of the plan as immoral when it was initially introduced.
I strongly oppose that particular plan because I thought it was unjust that future generations have to pay for our debt and the debt of those before. I apologize to members who I offended in that because my comment was not directed at them. It was directed at the result of that proposal.
But Parnell says even if he does not like that specific idea, he's willing to hear other proposals in an effort to come up with an agreement that works for both the executive and legislative branches.
I am open to a bill and working with legislators on that, whether something that I file or whether something they file. I just want the problem fixed for Alaskans.
The governor's retirement bill will get its first hearing on Saturday. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The Inuit Circumpolar Council is holding a meeting in Nome next week. The topic is food security, and the goal is to create a framework to understand the issue from an Inuit perspective. KNOM's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
Carolina Behay is the ICC Alaska Traditional Knowledge and Science Advisor and is organizing the event.
And overall, it's to teach how to take a food security lens to the entire environment. Food security is synonymous with environmental health.
Communities and organizations across the Bering Strait region elected traditional knowledge experts to serve as representatives at the session. Behe says the meeting evolved after the ICC identified food security as a top priority for Alaska Natives, but did not have a community understanding of that term.
And so we started doing the research, and we found that there's over 800 definitions to food security. Only one of those that I have found so far is from an indigenous community, and none of them are from the Arctic.
These alternative definitions, Behe says, are based on purchasing power, how much money an individual has to buy food, and the nutritional and caloric value of that food.
Those things are really very, very important. But within the Inupiat and Yupik culture, food means a lot more than how many calories you're getting. It includes spirituality. It includes the clothes that you're getting. It includes transfer of knowledge. It includes language. It includes your relationship with the environment or how we're taught to be within that environment. So all of these things have to be considered if you're to consider food security.
Two previous meetings were held in Barrow and Kotzebue, and another meeting is scheduled for Bethel later this year. The collected information will be peer-reviewed by a traditional knowledge advisory committee and then dispersed to tribal councils, industries, agencies, and the International Arctic Council. Behe says ConocoPhillips has already expressed interest in the project, and Inuit communities want to share the information with developers. In Nome, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
After 2 months of protests, Delta Western fuel workers in Unalaska have voted to unionize. The Inland Boatmen's Union of the Pacific got the support of a slim majority in an election last night. Leo Dasio is a dock driver for Delta Western on the night shift. He couldn't be there when the votes were counted, but he was glad to hear the results.
I was happy, and all of the guys. Right now, we could start to bargain with the employer. You know, we're ready to sit down with them.
Before that can happen, the NLRB has to certify the election. Both the union and the fuel company are talking with lawyers to figure out if they want to file grievances related to the election. Those complaints could lead to a hearing or possibly a new vote. Kirk Payne is the president of Delta Western. He says the company is taking things one step at a time.
You know, my understanding is the NLRB will go through, you know, if there's objections or not objections, you know, they'll have to finalize this part of the process. And then at some point, we begin to negotiate with the union.
Payne says each side would come up with a bargaining team and hash out a deal. He says that could take up to 2 years, but he hopes that's not the case. But in the meantime, Payne says nothing should change for Delta Western's workers in Unalaska. If the election is finalized and a contract negotiated, Unalaska would have the only unionized Delta Western terminal in the state. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the booming underground puppet scene in Haines.
There are some puppet styles, for instance, that take real skill and takes months and months and months of training, years, really, to be good.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Share your culture and create lifelong connections by welcoming an AFS International Exchange student from one of 90 countries into your home. Information at 1-800-AFS-INFO. This message sponsored by AFS USA.
Evidence used to get a conviction for a 1987 Fairbanks murder trial is in question. The Alaska Innocence Project is pursuing post-conviction relief for Michael Alexander, who was imprisoned for the March 23, 1987 kidnapping and killing of Fairbanks teenager Kathy Stockholm. The Innocence Project request challenges biological evidence that helped convict Alexander, and the group's director, Bill Oberle, says the FBI has concurred it could be suspect.
We recently received news from the FBI that they have reviewed the testimony that their examiner gave in the Alexander trial, and they've preliminarily concluded that that testimony exceeded what science would support.
Oberle says the state agreed at a hearing this week to have hairs used to tie Alexander to the killing retested.
The forensic testimony of that evidence at the time of trial was pretty rudimentary, and we have a much more discerning way to test it now, that's DNA testing, and that's what we've asked the court to do.
Oberle says Alaska state troopers have so far been unable to locate the hair samples. The Innocence Project also wants biological evidence found on the victim's clothing DNA tested, but Oberle says it's also unclear if that evidence can be located. Wildland firefighters are gearing up for the upcoming 2014 fire season. According to the Bureau of Land Management's Alaska Fire Service, fire season could come fast to parts of the Tanana Valley and South Central Alaska. KUAC's Emily Schwing has more.
The BLM Alaska Fire Service will work with the U.S. Army Garrison Alaska through early June to conduct routine prescribed burns over nearly 60,000 acres. Mel Slater is the public affairs officer for the fire service. He says the plan is to reduce fire danger as summer weather heats up.
Well, these are areas that over the years have had debris, fallen trees, grass, those kinds of things that have built up.
The BLM and the Army have worked together in years past to conduct prescribed burns to prevent fires that could be associated with military training. Slater says the two agencies are re-evaluating their practices prior to the upcoming fire season and in response to the nearly 90,000-acre Stewart Creek II fire that was ignited during an Army training mission northeast of Fairbanks last summer.
Well, there are agreements that are in place between the Army and BLM Alaska Fire Service that says who will provide what kinds of services, and those negotiations are just taking a look at those agreements and making modifications when necessary.
Forecasters expect the fire season to come on strong in parts of Alaska's south central and western regions due to low snowpack and above normal early spring temperatures. Parts of the Tanana Valley, prone to warm winds, also known as Chinooks, may also see heightened fire danger in May. But Slater says fire prediction is complicated.
Well, trying to predetermine what kind of fire season we're going to have is a pretty difficult guessed at best. Right now, it's kind of hard to say what's going to happen. I mean, we still have snow on the ground, so we're still trying to figure out how we're going to do our prescribed fires right now.
Prescribed burns are planned for the Donnelly Training Area, the Yukon Training Area, Fort Wainwright, and Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson near Anchorage. But recent snowfall has pushed back the burning. Slater says it was supposed to start this week, but the fire service and the Army are reworking that schedule. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Gakona's High-Frequency Active Auroral Research Program, better known as HARP, is slated for the junk pile. But a group of University of Alaska researchers are trying to stave off a Department of Defense move to scuttle the often misunderstood scientific facility. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
It's been both praised and maligned. Praised by scientists as a tool to gain knowledge about Earth's ionosphere. Maligned as a secret means to develop an ultimate weapon. The HARP resembles a giant radio antenna. Its 180 towers are 78 feet tall and have been beaming radio waves into the atmosphere since 1997. The facility covers about 30 acres of Department of Defense land just off the Tok cutoff, not far from Gakona Junction. The news of its imminent shutdown has alarmed the scientific community. Bob McCoy directs the University of Alaska Fairbanks Geophysical Institute.
We're up here in the subarctic where we can see the aurora and how the sun connects to the Earth along magnetic lines at high latitudes. But it'd be a shame if this facility went away.
McCoy says there are only three facilities like it in the world.
There's one in Norway and one in Russia. But HARP is much more flexible. It's got a wider frequency range. It's got quite a bit more power.
HARP and UAF research projects have been linked for years, and major universities throughout the United States remotely access the HARP facility and its information, Cornell and Rice among them. That's why recent news that the Department of Defense plans to abandon HARP galvanized McCoy and fellow scientists to make their case to save HARP to the Secretary of Defense earlier this year.
So a lot of us realize how significant the facility is, so we're trying to figure out ways to keep it alive as an active scientific tool. Last March, the National Academy did a workshop. They invited in 40-something scientists to to testify about the value of the science that has been done and could be done in the future from HAARP.
It is a question of money. In these federal budget-cutting times, the roughly $4 million a year needed to maintain the facility is getting scrutinized. HAARP is owned by the Air Force Research Laboratory, but is operated by an Anchorage contractor, Marsh Creek. Steve Floyd is the principal systems engineer for Marsh Creek. He says HAARP's money woes started with last year's sequestration cuts.
Our contract through Marsh Creek to run the facility came to an end in the middle of June 2013. And I guess it's the sequestration cuts that really squeezed the budget, and the Air Force Research Lab decided to save some money and take it dark for a while.
But Floyd says the cost-cutting measures are ill-advised because the research HAARP does is invaluable. Floyd says the ionosphere has a strong impact on satellite communications, but not enough is known about how that works.
So we're transmitting out with a focused beam, doing a very, very, very minute but detectable stimulation of the plasma of the ionosphere with these what are really very standard shortwave radio transmissions, but it's just enough to do a cause and effect study of the ionosphere.
Floyd says the research conducted in Gakona has far-reaching implications for both military and commercial communication systems.
HAARP is in Alaska because we wanted to be underneath a region of concentrated ionosphere, which is called the auroral oval, and we all have marveled at the northern lights. And what that's doing is that's painting out this hollow ring of concentrated ionosphere that's caused by the Earth's magnetic field. And we want it to be underneath of that auroral oval a good percentage of the time.
He says there's no better site than Gakona for the research facility. Bob McCoy agrees. McCoy and his fellow researchers argue there's a lot more science to be done in Gakona. McCoy says there's a possibility that the Defense Department could find an entity willing to share the costs of HAARP's upkeep. Meredith Mingledorf, a public information officer with the Air Force Research Laboratory at Kirtland Air Force Base in New Mexico, says the Air Force favors the transition of the HAARP facility to a basic research organization. But that depends on funding. If no other organization can be found to pay expenses, the Air Force plans to decommission the research site in June of this year. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. Enjoy a lunchtime talk with Dennis Hayes, CEO of the world's most energy-efficient commercial building, on Thursday, May 1st, during the 6th Annual Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference at the Denina Center. Individual tickets for this keynote luncheon can be purchased at bceaconference.com or 929-7770. Clean energy, it's everyone's business. This message sponsored by REAP.
Ketchikan, Kotzebue,
Dillingham, Sitka, Chugiak,
Fairbanks, Fort Yukon, Wrangell,
Barrow, Unalaska, Dutch Harbor, Alaknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Lisa Fu. This week on AK, Puppet Town. Haines seems like a quintessential Southeast Alaska town. There are eagles, bears, salmon, big mountains, and rough water. It's a picture book, no stoplight, no movie theater, low-crime type of community. But there's a seedier and eclectic side of Haines that emerged late this winter, the underground puppet scene. From member station KHNS, Margaret Friedenauer reports.
We aren't talking about Muppets. Those fuzzy, funny, and googly-eyed characters are not the same as puppets. Not in Haines, Alaska. Here, there are at least three puppet troupes, dozens of self-taught puppeteers and puppet makers, and one artist who has traveled to Europe to explore the history of puppetry, Bernd Power.
And what I saw is I saw a puppet troupe who was doing things with I don't know, it looked like stuff from their backyards, kind of things you'd find at the Salvation Army, rusting metal, old toys and such. And I said, we could do that.
That's Power at the Sheldon Museum in Haines, where he helped curate the puppet exhibit Strung Up and Reconfigured. Power is sort of the father of puppetry in Haines. Almost 10 years ago, he gathered a group of artists and formed a puppet troupe. Here's artist Debbie Knight Kennedy explaining how she fell into the puppet scene.
Burns came up to me one day before I knew him very well, and he said, so, you're a doll maker. So, you can make your dolls talk. I'm starting a puppet troupe. That was it. It's all over for me, you know?
After a few years, Power stayed with traditional puppetry, while some in the group wandered in a different direction. Now the group is called Geppetto's Junkyard and consists of more than a dozen people, including a plumber, a yogi, a boat builder, retired teacher, jujitsu instructor, and others. This winter, they created a show called Space Lust. It was described on posters as a cross between steampunk, space cowboy, and puppet space opera. It was a wild scene of live music, special effects, acting, and of course, puppets.
That's it, Joey.
Blue moon, you left me standing alone.
The puppets are all handmade and usually assembled from found objects like bicycle parts, kitchen gadgets, vacuum hoses, and wood. Knight Kennedy's husband, Gene Kennedy, is also in the troupe. He is a handyman and plumber, but is drawn to creating puppets like the carved wooden horse he made with multiple moving parts.
This is why I like it. It's all wooden cutout plywood. Basically, there's four parts to the body, and there's two levers that work in tandem, and the head swings and on its own and is counterweighted with lead weight so that it always comes back to the same place.
Geppetto's Junkyard has their fans. They pack in the sporadic shows. But no one, especially the puppeteers and actors, pretend they are traditionalists. Power is more so. Back at the museum, he says he doesn't think anyone in Haines is true to traditional puppetry.
But there are some puppet styles, for instance, that are take real skill to manipulate. It's not as simple as you just stick your hand up and you move your, wiggle it around. I mean, you learn very definite things about how to move your hand. And it takes months and months and months of training, years, really, to be good.
Of the more than 100 puppets in the exhibit, about two-thirds were made locally. There was even one that might be local from several generations ago. It's a bone, shell, and sinew Tlingit puppet on loan from the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Power says he's drawn to puppets because they still surprise people. He says when he goes on the road with a show, he's not pigeonholed because puppets are still edgy and intriguing enough to cross all ages and interests.
Because if you have a music group, you say to someone, oh, what kind of music do you have? And they say, and you say, whatever your style of music is, and they say, you play there. But if you have a puppet troupe, the first question out of my mind when I would try to book, find some place to play is it for children? And I go, well, not particularly. And as soon as you say that, they're completely blank. Okay. And you can play for anybody.
And maybe that's why puppets and Haines go together. For puppeteers like Melina Shields with Geppetto's Junkyard, it makes perfect sense.
I think that there's just inherently something sort of creative that happens by taking these found objects and then letting the puppets be born into whoever they are. And it's just magic.
Reporting from the self-proclaimed puppet capital of Alaska, in Haines, I'm Margaret Friednauer.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're heading to Kasan, located in southeast Alaska on Prince of Wales Island. The coastal native village is home to the oldest Haida building in the world.
Sinadung Haidung Gilagung Kiosgansi Hinodikian. I'm Frederick Otilius Olson Jr., and I'm from Kasan. I'm a Eagle. I'm a Haida, Alaskan Haida. You'd see the greenest trees. You'd see a lot of water. You probably, if you couldn't see, you'd feel a lot of water falling on you. And a surprising amount all day long, maybe for weeks. And clean air, friendly people. Sand is kind of funny. You know, people of working age either work for the tribe, Organized Village of Kasan, or there's a few jobs with the city of Kasan, and some people work in, they might live in Kasan, but they work in another community or, you know, have seasonal work and whatnot. Oh, for fun and tradition, at the same time, one might walk out to Naiwan, the whale house, as it's known widely, the last traditional Haida building in the United States, currently being restored. It was never originally built or intended to be a community hall or anything. You know, it was Sheikh Sanihat's home, his wife and extended family like that. It's exciting. We're following in our ancestors' footsteps and in their footprint of the building. It was originally built where it is now in 1880. Kasan was one of the hardest hit by diseases of contact. That may have been one of the reasons that led Sanihat to build the house where he did, because of all the deaths. In our part of Southeast Alaska, you can have days where it's sort of in the 40s somewhere, kind of rainy. You could have that day any time of the year, even July, November, where a temperate rainforest would get well over 100 inches of rain a year. Just where I want to be, it's hard to explain.
Frederick Otilius Olson Jr. is from Kasan. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. If you want to hear your community featured, send us an email at news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Margaret Friedenauer, Jolene Amendadas, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from across the state. I'm Lisa Fu.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Anna Rose MacArthur in Nome, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Dan Bross and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. If you're ready to quit tobacco or just thinking about it, the coaches at Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, a free service for all Alaska adults, can support you with Text to Quit, with tools to make your quit attempt successful. Text to Quit helps you stay in touch with your quit coach, use nicotine replacement medications properly, manage those urges to use tobacco, and prevent relapses, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are important members of our workforce, from healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants. Alaskans who are in recovery or experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, or mental health conditions are succeeding in the workplace. The Trust encourages businesses to consider ways in which employing trust beneficiaries can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.